Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. We are conducting an exclusive interview with David Millier, a leading and widely known security authority and board member, Sector Advisory Council. Dave, thank you for coming in today to share your deep insights with the audience.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to sharing some of my experiences and some of my insights into the security industry.
Dave, can you provide a profile of your roles and challenges?
Sure. In my 17-plus years of experience in the security industry, I've played a number of different roles. Security consultant, certainly, as a lot of people start out as. And then I've moved up to play the role of CTO, Chief Information Security Officer, and currently I play the role of CEO. The interesting thing to me, I think, in this industry is that, you know, my roles have changed over the years, but I faced a lot of the same challenges. And when I look at sort of back over the time that I've spent in security, one of the things that I think that it really a lot of it boils down to, and one of the commonalities, if you will, across all of them, is a simple question. Do you want to be compliant or do you want to be secure? And I think what I've sort of discovered over the years and what I work towards now is the idea that you don't have to make a choice between those two. There's a way to ensure that your organization is compliant while still ensuring that you're meeting security needs.
Dave, you know, you talked about your history, and I know it's incredibly strong, and as a result, you serve on various committees and boards and so on, because people really want that experience and that breadth of knowledge that you have. And for that reason, we're going to mine that a bit. And that, what would you say are your recommendations for security governance?
From a security governance perspective, I think one of the first things and most fundamental things that an organization needs to do is get management buy-in into anything they're trying to put together. If you're creating a security program, if you're creating security policies, even if you're putting together security teams in order to deal with things internally, without that management buy-in, you're not going to be able to move things forward. And it's one of the biggest frustrations that we see from a customer side and even from our side when we're helping companies to put together security solutions. Without that management buy-in and that, you know, agreement that they're going to follow that governance and they're going to ensure that it happens, you never really seem to move things forward. So that's one of the number one things is get that management buy-in.
Dave, can you profile defense in depth?
Sure. You know, over the years, a lot of times we've taken, from a security point, a single approach, a single tool or a single solution in order to satisfy a specific need. One of the things we've seen, though, as the technologies and even as methodologies and processes have matured in the security industry, we've seen a lot more of a move towards the idea of providing multiple layers of security so that even if one of the layers is breached, there's a compensating control or there's an offsetting layer of security somewhere further within the network or on a system itself in order to deal with that specific problem. So as we see more attacks in the wild, as we see newer and more sophisticated threats, the idea of blended threats, you know, multiple threats being combined together, the defense in depth strategy really is a shrewd and conservative approach for most of the organizations today.
Do you have an example?
Sure. I mean, the most common example, and we talk about when it comes to viruses and things like that, is the idea of being able to have multiple technologies in place, complementary technologies, something at the desktop and something different at a server. So, for example, with an email with Microsoft and their Forefront solution, you may have the Microsoft Forefront client installed on all the desktops, but then you leverage the Microsoft for Exchange service that's running on the Exchange server itself looking at the email so that even if a virus got through a mail server, it didn't get picked up by the signatures that are, you know, looking for viruses at the mail server, ideally the different technology that's on the client desktop will pick it up.
What are your best practices regarding virus protection?
Well, to build on that last comment, there is the idea of, again, using that multiple layered approach to virus protection. So don't rely on the same vendor normally, I would say, for, you know, desktop protection and server protection. Microsoft, I think, is a unique differentiator, and it's a great exception to that rule in that because their Microsoft Forefront for Exchange product actually doesn't use the Microsoft antivirus signatures, it leverages the signatures of multiple other vendors. You have the ability to have other vendors' technology from a signature perspective being used while still taking advantage of Microsoft's, you know, ability to talk very rapidly with their own equipment because, of course, it's their own software. So you have the ability of having different client software and different server software, again, providing that, you know, defense in depth approach.
Can you talk more about malware removal and your recommendations?
Sure. I think one of the biggest weaknesses with malware is that, unlike a virus where it's sort of black and white, I've got this particular virus, it's been detected by my antivirus software, it's been deleted or it's not been deleted, it's been cleaned or it's not been cleaned. When it comes to malware, because there's so many different attack vectors, how it can get into systems and what it can do when it's in systems, in most cases, I recommend, based on my experience with it, the challenge or the reality of trying to clean it is sometimes not as effective as we'd like it to be, and there's always that nagging doubt at the back of your mind of whether or not did I really get rid of everything that, you know, this piece of malware that has brought into my system? Did it bring anything else down that I'm not aware of? So in 99% of the cases, unless you're 100% certain that you've been able to clean that malware out, I usually recommend that people actually rebuild the system from scratch. So start out with a new image. Microsoft provides lots of technologies to make it very quick and efficient to be able to keep images available on the network to very quickly redeploy systems. So much easier, and in fact, in a lot of cases, it's faster to rebuild the system from an image than it is to spend the time trying to manually go through and confirm that you've removed all of the malware.
So what is your viewpoint in comments regards to the people element in corporations and security?
So one of the biggest, I guess, and people really are the weakest link, as we well know, when it comes to security, because we can put all the technology in place that we want to, but people will usually find a way to get around it, either on purpose if they're, you know, trying to do malicious activities, or even more unfortunately, a lot of times they find ways to work around it when they're not trying to. When it comes to information and when it comes to protecting information and preventing that information from leaving an organization, however, most companies have not taken sufficient steps in order to protect their information. And so it's very easy for information to walk out of organizations today, and most companies don't know about it. With the the proliferation of USB keys and flash drives and even iPods and cameras that have large storage on them, so much information is being taken out of companies, going to competitors, and in a lot of cases, in most cases, the companies aren't even aware of it, and they may never become aware of it. They may become aware of it indirectly because, for example, they start losing sales or their clients start leaving them to go to a new competitor. But even then, if they think there's something that's happened, in almost very few cases are they actually able to prove it or be able to trace it back to an individual. So the biggest challenge, I think, on that people side is really getting restrictions in place and being able to understand what's happening.
Can you overview some of the key products within the Forefront Security product suite and really some of the ones that you really like?
Sure. From a Forefront really has the three focuses, the client protection, the server protection, and then the network, the edge protection, if you will. On the client side, Microsoft's done a great job of creating a small footprint client. It's one of the smallest ones on the market, and it's, of course, because it's native Microsoft technology. On the server, I really like, my favorite product is the Microsoft Forefront for Exchange, and I love it because it has the ability to scan up the user, to leverage up to 5 different vendors' scanning engines to provide defense in depth, but right in that one spot. So rather than having to invest in multiple different technologies or invest in multiple different servers and have mail go through multiple different hops and be scanned and scanned and scanned, Microsoft's solution allows it all to be scanned from one single source while still leveraging multiple other vendors' technologies as it relates to the actual antivirus signatures. So much higher probability of picking viruses up before they ever get a chance to proliferate through within the network itself. From the edge, of course, the ISA server, Microsoft's firewall, as well as the IAG, which allows all of the SSL proxying and that. Again, the technology has matured quite a bit. Microsoft has really put a lot of effort into creating a complete suite of products. They've moved away, I guess, from the one-off approach that they used to have. And as a security professional, although a few years ago I might not have been able to say it quite as easily, today, based on the complete offering, I'm confident in recommending the Microsoft Forefront Security solution.
How about on the sort of the Web 2 front? Anything there?
I think the idea, again, from a content point, because that's one of the big areas that things are changing and maturing, is on content, and it's on active content, and it's on real-time content. And so the IAG especially is designed to really enable that type of acceleration of that information, and then to make it easily accessible to the right users. And so absolutely, I think that, again, Microsoft made huge strides in that regard.
Can you provide your recommendations for security solution accelerators?
Sure. Microsoft, again, sort of in trying to enhance their overall approach to security and on making it as easy as possible for their users to be able to benefit from their security, has created a nice suite of the compliance management toolkits for XP, for Vista, for Server 2003, and Server 2008. I really like the accelerators because they give you quick access to guides, attack surfaces, different ways that machines can be compromised, and they've put together a really comprehensive set of baseline settings for each of the operating systems. And one of the things that I really like about the Security Solutions Accelerators is the GPO Accelerator, which is the Group Policy Accelerator, which allows you to really quickly take what Microsoft has identified from a best practices perspective and from a baseline settings of what every server or every operating system should have from a protection point and quickly deploy them out into the network so you're able to get the machines, get some compliance on the machines in a very rapid fashion.
Again, based on your extensive experience of being out there in the real world, what's a simple and effective way to measuring network security?
Well, people like to think that it's very difficult to measure security, and I think that from a good point, it's become a lot easier over time, but it really, in my opinion, takes three things. You need to have policies, you need to have something that defines what you're supposed to be doing. You need to have some type of technology or methodology or process in place in order to enforce that policy. And then you need to have a way to measure the effectiveness or the compliance of that enforcement. And it's, you know, the easy and effective approach is to take the policies and then break them down and say, you know, how do we measure whether the control exists? So, for example, if it's a password policy that says passwords need to change every 90 days, how do we make sure that that password policy is in place, and then how do we make sure that it's actually working the way it's supposed to? So, you know, as an example, we might be checking the Active Directory or checking the GPO to say, hey, is the setting turned on for everybody so that there's a forced password change every 90 days? And then on a periodic basis, daily, weekly, monthly, quarterly, depending on what the specific organization's requirements are, we may be forced to take a look at, you know, sample random accounts and say, has this user's account been changed within the last 90 days? So it allows us to have sort of a yes or no. Yes or no, is there a policy in place that actually is required to you know, to make this happen? And then test, you know, so test and validate. Is there actually accounts, or, you know, when I check these accounts, have they all had their password forced changed within the last 90 days?
Can you comment on 2009, the year of whitelisting due to the economic climate?
Sure. I think that this year is going to be an interesting year in the security industry as it relates to management of tools and technologies and, frankly, in managing people. One of the most common things, of course, we do in the security world, and it's really being forced on us more from the IT side and from the business side, is that people, you know, systems are being put in place to let people do a specific job or to do a specific job function. And everything we want to do from a security point is to prevent the users from doing things they're not supposed to be doing. The typical approach is to allow users to do just about everything on the systems and then try to figure out ways to prevent them from doing things that are inappropriate or to prevent things from the outside from coming in. One of the challenges to that, of course, is it takes a lot of manpower and it takes usually a lot of technology. So we're, especially now in you know, 2009 and maybe beyond, depending on how long this economic climate sort of stays the way it is and we see less dollars being dedicated to security and less dollars being dedicated to security resources, I think you're going to see a lot more of a move towards the idea of whitelisting, where instead of saying, let's let the users, you know, do pretty much what they want within reason and then try to figure out ways to stop them from doing it, you'll see very clearly defined lists of what people are allowed to do, and by default, you'll block everything else. So URL, you know, website surfing is a great example, where instead of letting everybody surf almost all the websites but trying to block them from going to certain sites, in most corporations, there's a very clearly defined list of website addresses you can come up with and say, these are the sites that my people need to be able to access on a regular basis. And then, of course, you can create exceptions. But it's much easier to create a few exceptions than it is to try to block those billions of other sites that you don't want to have access to. The same thing applies to applications. And, in fact, Windows 7, which is coming from Microsoft, has an application whitelisting component built into it specifically to address the need for application whitelisting. Instead of people being able to run any programs, or instead of malware being inadvertently downloaded, people being subjected to phishing and things like that, where they're getting applications installed on their machines or they're being redirected where they're not supposed to be, if you can get into application whitelisting and say, you know, we only have 3 or 4 or 5 or 10 specific applications that our users need to use in our organization, by default you can block everything else. So it adds to the validity of things like the defense in depth approach. It adds to the functionality, if you will, of the antivirus software, because things are being stopped from running before they even get a chance to run. And it also makes it much easier to manage and maintain from a security perspective. So the security professionals in the organization, if there even are any, aren't being tasked with running around trying to figure out what's going on from a bad perspective. They can focus on allowing or on monitoring what is happening because they know that the controls are in place to limit access.
Please comment on using security monitoring solutions to measure and validate service provider SLAs.
Sure. So one of the things that we see from most of the service providers, whether it's an outsourced service provider who's managing servers or managing the network itself, or whether it's an outsourced security provider, in most cases we're relying on the service provider to provide us with their own measurements of how well or how poorly they're doing. The reality there, of course, is that you're asking, you know, the fox to guard the hen house, in the sense that most service providers aren't going to tell you if they're doing a bad job because it's going to impact their ability to get paid or to keep, you know, keep you as a client. So from a security monitoring perspective, there's actually a fair amount that we can do for ourselves very easily, relatively inexpensively, to help us to validate, you know, SLAs from our providers, and also to make sure that providers, not just that they're meeting service level agreements, but also that they're doing things in the fashion that they've agreed to do them. So, you know, two examples I would use is user account creation, specifically as it relates to administrative accounts. And then change management control. You know, from a user account perspective, you know, the service provider typically, if they're creating accounts, they're doing it based on a need. You know, you've set up a need. And so when users are being added to things like a domain admin group or an administrative group, you'd want to know about it. And so those are things that from a monitoring perspective, if you're looking at logs, if you're looking at transactions on the systems themselves, very easy to pick up when things like that change. The other thing from a change control perspective comes down to things as an example like firewall rules. You may have a service provider who's managing your ISA firewall rule set. And so what you want to do is make sure that only changes are made within a specific window, a time window or a change management window. So typical service provider will log in and make changes when they see fit, and it doesn't always correspond with your schedule. So from a monitoring perspective, it's very easy to identify when those changes are being made. The other advantages of monitoring can be used, you know, using something like Microsoft's System Center Operations Manager or System Center Essentials. You can check availability of systems. So if the service provider is guaranteeing you a certain amount of uptime for your systems, it's very easy and relatively low cost to have your own monitoring solutions in place to help validate that those systems indeed are available for the amount of time that the service provider is claiming they are. And even again, when it comes to change management windows, are the machines offline for a longer period than is allowed under a change management window? And even things like bandwidth monitoring for you know, ISP links to make sure that the WAN bandwidth that you're supposed to be getting, you're actually getting what you're provisioned.
What can you say about tracking and compliance in a non-compliance world?
Well, we go back to some of our early points when I was talking about the idea of policy, you know, creating a policy and then enforcing that policy and then coming up with measures to measure the effectiveness or the compliance, if you will, of that enforcement. Most companies today are being asked to adhere to more and more, whether it's corporate policies, whether it's regulatory, you know, government has specific requirements, whether it's a publicly traded company that's trying to deal with things like Sarbanes-Oxley or here in Canada, Bill 198. There's all kinds of compliance requirements, and the reality is that very few companies, and frankly, I don't think you'll find many companies, are truly compliant. What they're doing usually is they have, you know, that snapshot where they'll have an assessment done or an evaluation done once a year to say, am I compliant right now? And so it feeds back into my question earlier of, do you want to be compliant or do you want to be secure? Just because you have an audit right now and that audit tells you that you're compliant, it does not mean that you're secure, because typically by the time the audit's done and you get your report back, things have already changed. We know network and security are very dynamic, so things change on an ongoing basis. So what companies really need to move towards in order to be able to do that effective tracking and in order to ensure compliance or at least awareness of compliance is to get into much more continuous auditing monitoring. So, you know, sort of seeing what's going on an ongoing basis, ensuring, again, going back to the policies and the enforcement points, that they're periodically checking, not just once a year, but on an ongoing basis so that, you know, once a month, once a quarter, whatever makes sense in their environment, to ensure that they're at least aware of items when they go out of compliance, and ideally they can work towards bringing them back into compliance as quickly as possible.
You have this incredible history, as I indicated, and a very sort of broad perspective, and for that reason I'm going to get you to look into your crystal ball. Can you provide your predictions of future IT and business security trends and their implications and opportunities?
Sure. I think, you know, from the MSSP, the Managed Security Services Provider perspective, which is where I come from, as well as the security consulting perspective, I see, you know, 2009, 2010 and beyond, depending on sort of, again, how the economic climate turns, I see huge opportunities in the security industry for us to really solidify how we deliver security into companies, to come up with very clear, measurable sets of deliverables into companies. And I see a big opportunity for security to really become ingrained because, you know, from an IT perspective, a lot of times traditionally what we've done is we've thrown a bunch of resources at it. We've bought a whack of technology, and sometimes it's worked and sometimes it hasn't. And so we go out and buy a new technology, or we go out and we hire more people and we just try it again in a different way. I don't think that luxury exists, certainly not right now, and likely won't for the next couple of years. So dollars are being watched a lot closer, which means that, you know, security solutions and security methodologies that are being put in place have to work. They have to do what they've been designed to do, and they need to do it, frankly, the first time around. So I think you're going to see a lot more trends towards that consolidation. I think if you look at the security tools side of the game, and Microsoft's no exception, you're going to see a lot more of a move towards consolidation of the tools and technologies. So Microsoft with ISA and IAG, you know, two different products, they're really moving towards having one product provide both of those functionalities. Other vendors are certainly doing the same thing, where they're moving towards having a single appliance, if you will, that does multiple functions or provides multiple capabilities. So we used to be afraid of that in the security industry because, again, it provided us with those single tools that weren't able to provide necessarily that defense in depth. Now that we're bringing it all together and now that we've seen the maturity of the industry, I think you're going to continue to see more and more tools and technologies that are complementary, existing or coexisting on the same hardware platforms or on virtualization platforms or on, you know, complementary technologies.
You know, it's easy for IT pros to become sort of confused in the landscape because there's just so much information out there. So, again, sort of reaching into your background, what are your top specific recommended resources and why?
Well, I'm a geek at heart, I guess, and so I read Slashdot every single day simply because it really is a source of security information, and it covers a lot of different topics, so it takes care of a lot of the different sides. I certainly hit Microsoft.com/security almost every day to see if Microsoft highlighted any new things that I should be aware of. I subscribe to a fair number of news groups and RSS feeds that provide security-specific information. And I use some crawlers that actually go through different websites, different news sites, looking for, you know, keywords like security, exploits, overflows, to try to find some of those, you know, hacks, if you will. And, of course, you get those from the bug tracks and things like that. And then also to identify, you know, specific news stories that are, you know, organizations being broken into or specific security hacks. You're seeing compromises happening, because those are things that may impact our industry, and they certainly may even impact some of our customers.
Are there any specific individuals that you follow through their blogs and so on?
Bruce Schneier is certainly a guru in the industry, and a lot of people look to Bruce, and I certainly read his, he has a blog or a newsletter that he sends out on a regular basis. I certainly look to that, and I read that on an ongoing basis.
Now I'm going to turn the tables here in that you're going to take the seat as the interviewer, so you're going to ask yourself questions and then give yourself the answers.
Sure. So I guess the question I would ask, you know, if I had to pick one single question is, and I'm a businessman as well as a security guy, so the question I think I would want to know is, you know, when are we going to see security as an industry, if you will, stabilize so that we can get back to running businesses? So when are we going to get beyond the point of having to worry about this new security attack or this new security problem, this new vulnerability, this new technology that, you know, some vendor has brought out, which is the next panacea, it's the next, you know, savior from the security industry? When are we going to get beyond that and see security as a stable, you know, as a stable industry, so we can just focus on growing our businesses and on keeping our businesses operation? I think, you know, to answer my question, unfortunately, I don't think that's going to happen for the foreseeable future. I think a reason for that, you know, it's based on the lack of dollars that are dedicated towards security, although that's been getting a lot better, and more companies are finally starting to put security as a separate, you know, dollar line, if you will, on the budget, rather than just lumping it all into IT. There's, you know, security in some cases in organizations. There's the physical aspect of security. We talk about the guards and the doors and things like that. And then we have logical security, and that logical security, unfortunately, sometimes get lumped in there. Sometimes, as they say, falls under IT. One of the interesting things, I guess, or one of the signs that I see this year that's a little bit optimistic is looking at people from a budgeting point. We've seen IT budgets shrink significantly this year. But if you look at the security component, when it's broken out as a separate line item, it looks like the security, you know, the security spend, if you will, is actually increasing. Is it really increasing? I don't think so. I think what you're seeing is the IT budget decreasing, so the component that's not security is going down, but the security component's not going down lock in step with the rest of the IT budget. So ideally, there's a bit more dollars being spent, and ultimately, over time, as security becomes more and more an acceptable, you know, a line item, if you will, to say an acceptable expense in order to, you know, keep businesses up and operational, I think that we may see some of that stability that I'm really looking for.
Dave, you know, you have this incredible background. Like I mentioned, you must have some interesting stories to tell.
I guess from a security point, one of the ones that, you know, frankly frightens me, I guess, when I look back at some of my, you know, experiences with clients where we've been called in to help out. We get engaged to help customers, right? We get brought in to help customers when it relates to compromises on the network, when it relates to suspected compromises. One of the worst ones, I guess, I've been involved with in the last couple of years revolved around an organization that, while they thought they had good security measures in place, they had firewalls, they had intrusion prevention system in place, they had, you know, they thought hardened their systems in that, received a phone call at about 2 o'clock in the morning from the FBI informing them that their systems had actually been compromised by a group of Eastern European hackers, and they were in the process of trying to steal a significant amount of information. And while the FBI wasn't offering to help them do anything about it, they wanted to make sure that they were at least unofficially aware of it. So we were called in after hours, brought in to try to help them figure out how the heck this could be happening. And the scary part for me was that, you know, they had the firewalls in place. They had a wonderful intrusion prevention solution, not just an intrusion detection, but actually an intrusion prevention system in place. But none of the rules on the intrusion prevention system were set to block any type of malicious activity. And so we helped turn those on right away, which, of course, helped us shut down the attack. We were able to identify it, shut it down, get it locked down, and did an investigation and determined that no information had been stolen. But when I looked at it after the fact, and we sort of had a, you know, a debrief meeting afterwards, and the CIO of the company is saying, hey, how is it possible that we have all this technology and we have this tool in place and it's set to not block any type of this activity? You know, the internal IT guy who was also, unfortunately, the IT guy was responsible for security as well, and it's a typical organization where not enough resources to do the job, indicated he didn't have time to deal with all of the, you know, false positives, if you will, where things were being blocked that shouldn't be blocked. And so he had just chosen to, you know, leave it in monitor mode and only see things that were happening. And, of course, somebody has to be looking at the console, especially if you're under attack like these guys were. Somebody would have to have been looking at the console at 2 o'clock in the morning to see that that was happening. So I see that a lot in organizations where, you know, with the best of intentions, people buy technology, they invest in technology, but they don't deploy the technology effectively, and then they don't put the resources in place in order to be able to take advantage of it.
Well, Dave, you know, we will continue to follow your significant contributions, and we thank you for sharing your time, wisdom, and accumulated deep insights with our audience.
Well, thank you for having me, and it's been great, and hopefully I can help out again in the future and offer my insights at another time.
This concludes our exclusive interview with David Millier, a leading and widely acknowledged security authority, board member, Sector Advisory Council.